I had for like 20 whole minutes every day. I even got laundered twice and nothing.
I think you look dashing, I said. He settled down at the center of the dashboard, his legs hanging off and kicking idly.
Thank you, my lord.
So the pizza came on schedule while I was, away?
Yes, my lord. The Lady Lavanshi provided it in your stead.
Toot lowered his voice and talked from between clenched teeth.
If she hadn't, these knuckleheads would have deserted.
Well, we do have a deal, I said. That's what a deal means, right?
Right,
Toot said firmly.
We trust you, Harry. You're barely like a human at all.
I knew he meant it as a compliment, but something chilly slithered down my back at the statement. My fairy godmother, the Lenanshi, had covered my obligations at home while I was gone? Man, that could get complicated. Among the Shi, favors are hard currency. But I was glad to see Toot and his gang. They were damned handy, and could be far more dangerous and capable than most, even in the supernatural world, I realized. I never doubted you or the guard for a second, Major General. Which was true. I had no doubt at all that as long as the pizza kept flowing, I'd have their absolute loyalty. Toot beamed at the compliment, and his body pulsed with a gentle aura of cool blue light.
How can the guard serve you, my lord?
They'd started off the evening nearly crashing the car, but it was impressive they'd managed it at all. I'm on a case, I said seriously. I'll need someone to watch my back.
Lean forward a little, my lord,
Toot said instantly and shouted,
Hey, Colonel Purpleweed! Come watch the Tsar Winterlord Knight's back!
I fought not to smile. No, that's a metaphor, I said. Toot frowned and scratched his head.
I don't know what it's for.
Mustn't laugh. Mustn't. It would crush his little feelings. In a minute. I'm going to pull over and go into a building. I want guards to stay inside and around the car, and I want a couple more to go with me and make sure no one sneaks up on me when I'm not looking.
Oh, Toot said. That's easy.
Good, I said as I pulled the car over. Make it so. Toot saluted, leapt into the air, and zipped back to the rear compartment, piping orders as he went. I set the old caddy's parking brake and got out, wasting no time. I didn't hold the door open any longer than I would have if I'd been alone. The little folk do not need that kind of coddling. They're not always bright, but they're fast, tough, and resourceful. I'd have had trouble keeping them in the car if I wanted to. Once I was out and moving, I was to all appearances alone. Whoever Toot had sent to watch my back would be silent and nearly invisible, and I didn't bother rubbernecking around to try to spot them. One thing about the little folk that held as well with every fairy, when they made a deal, they stuck to it. They'd had my back before, and they had it now. Heck, since I was committing a felony, they probably thought it was fun to come along for the ride. It's tough to get one of the little folk to care about discipline. On the other hand, they really aren't terribly impressed with danger, either. I walked about a block to the right apartment building, a brownstone blockhouse that had all the flair and imaginative design of a brick of baking chocolate. It wasn't an upscale place like where my brother lived, but it wasn't one of the projects at their worst, either. It didn't have a doorman, and the security wouldn't be top of the line, and that was, for now, the important thing. I got a little bit lucky on the way in. A resident, a man in his 20s who had apparently been out drinking, opened the door on his way home, and I called out, "Hold that, please!" He did. He probably shouldn't have. But guys in tuxes, even without a tie, don't strike anyone as a criminal upon first impression. I nodded to him and thanked him with a smile. He muttered something bleary and turned down a side hallway. I hit the elevators and took one up. Once I was on the right floor, the rest wasn't too tough. I walked calmly down the hallway to the proper door and leaned against it. A ripple of goose flesh washed up my arm, beginning on the back of my hand, and I jerked my fingers back in pure instinct. Huh. There were wards on the door, magical defenses. I hadn't expected that. Wards can do all kinds of things to an intruder, from suggesting that he turn around and leave, to giving him a stiff push away, to frying him like a bug zapper. I took a moment to study the wards. They were a smooth patchwork of enchantment, probably the result of several lesser talents working together. Somebody like me can put up a ward that is like a huge iron wall. This was more like a curtain of tightly interwoven steel rings. For most purposes, both would serve fairly well. But with the right tool, the latter kind of wall is easily dealt with. "And I'm the tool," I muttered. Then I thought about it, sighed, and shook my head. "One day," I told myself, "one brave and magnificent day, I will actually be cool." I rested my fingertips lightly on the door and went over the wards in my thoughts. Aha! Had I tried to break in, the wards would have set off an enormous racket and a bunch of smoke, along with a sudden intense sensation of claustrophobia. Fire alarms would have gone off, and sprinklers, and the authorities would have been summoned. That was a nominally effective defense all by itself, but the claustrophobia bit was really masterful. The noise would trip off an instinctive adrenaline response. And that, combined with the induced panic of the ward, would send just about anything scurrying for the exit, rather than take chances in what would have been a very noisy and crowded environment. That kind of subtle manipulation always works best amidst a flurry of distractions. Washington's been doing it like that for decades. I cut the wards off from their power source one at a time, trying to keep the damage to a minimum so that it would be easy to fix. I already felt bad enough over what I was about to do. Then, once the wards were offline, I took a deep breath and leaned against the door with a sudden thrust of my legs and body. I'd been working out. The doorframe splintered and gave way, and I slipped quickly and quietly into Waldo Butters's apartment. It was dark inside, and I didn't know it well enough to navigate without light. I left the door a little bit open so that the light from the hall would leak in. This was the dangerous part. If someone had heard the noise, they'd be calling the cops. I needed to be gone in the next 5 minutes. I crossed the living room to the short hallway. Butters's bedroom was on the right, his computer room on the left. The bedroom door was closed. There was a faint light in the computer room. I entered. There were several computers set up around the walls of the room, which I knew Butters and company used for some kind of group computer game-related thingy they all did together. The computers were all turned off except for one, the biggest one in the corner, which sat facing out into the room. Butters called it the captain's chair. He sat there and coordinated some kind of game activity. Raids, I think they were called, and they went on into the wee hours. His job required him to work nights, and he claimed it helped him keep circadian rhythm to play video games on his off nights. That monitor was on, and in the reflection in the glass of the room's single window, I could see that the screen had been divided into maybe a dozen sections, and every single one of them was playing a different pornographic scenario. A human skull sat on the table, facing the monitor, and faint orange flickers of light danced in its eyes. Despite its utter inability to form any expression, it somehow gave the impression of a happily glazed look. I'd been in the room for about 2 seconds when the computer made an awful sound, coughed out a little puff of smoke, and the monitor screen went black. I winced. My fault. Wizards and technology don't get along so well, and the more advanced the technology is, the sooner something seems to go wrong, especially with electronics. Butters had been cobbling together a theory to explain why the world worked like that, but I'd drawn the line at covering my head in a tinfoil hat in the name of science. The skull let out a startled, disappointed sound, and after several disoriented flickers, its eyelights panned around the room and landed on me.
"Harry," said the skull.
It didn't move its jaws to form the words or anything. They just came out.
"Hell's bells, you're back from the dead?"
"From the mostly dead," I replied. "You made it out of Omaha Beach, huh?"
"You kidding?" Bob said. "The minute you were clear, I ran like a bunny and hid."
You could have taken that jerk, I said.
Why would I want to?
Bob asked.
So, when do we set up the new lab? And can I have broadband?
His eyes gleamed with avarice or something near it.
I need broadband, Harry.
That's a computer thing, right?
Philistine, Bob the Skull muttered.
Bob wasn't a skull, per se. He was a spirit of air, or intellect, or one of any of a great many other terms used to describe such beings. The skull was the vessel that he inhabited, kind of like a genie's bottle. Bob had been working as an assistant and advisor to wizards since before crossbows had gone out of style, and he'd forgotten more about the ins and outs of magical theory than I knew. He'd been my assistant and friend since I'd first come to Chicago. I hadn't realized until I actually heard his voice how much I'd missed the demented little perv.
"When do we get to work?"
Bob asked brightly. "I am working," I said. "I need to talk to you."
"I'm all ears," Bob said, "except for the ears part."
Bob blinked.
"Are you wearing a tux?"
Yeah.
"Tell me you did not get married."
"I didn't get married," I said, "except for the whole Mab thing, which is creepy and weird. She spent the last 3 months trying to kill me once a day."
"Sounds like her style," Bob said. "How did you get out of it?"
I said.
"Oh," Bob said. Oh, maybe you should go, Harry."
"Relax," I said. "I know you've had your issues with Mab, but I'm the only one here."
"Yeah, that's kind of the part that bothers me."
I scowled at him. "Oh, come on. How long have you known me?"
"Harry, you're Mab's hitman."
"Yeah, but I'm not here to hit you," I said.
"You could be lying," Bob said. "Maybe the she can't lie, but you can."
"Hell's bells, I'm not lying."
"But how do I know that?"
"Because I haven't hit you already?" I frowned at him. "Wait a minute. You're stalling me, aren't you?"
"Stalling you?"
Bob asked brightly.
"What do you mean?"
There was no warning, none at all. The door to Butters's bedroom exploded outward, sending splinters of cheap plywood sailing everywhere. A missile of living muscle hit me in the back at almost the same instant, shoving my chest forward and whiplashing my head back. My spine lit up like a casino, and I felt myself driven hard to the ground. Something powerful and snarling and terribly strong came down on top of me, and I felt claws and fangs begin to rake at me. Guess I used up all my evening's luck on the front door guy. Chapter 10. Claws shredded my tux, raking over my back, my buttocks, and the backs of my legs. Jaws would have gotten hold of my neck if I hadn't gotten my hands in the way, clamping them tight over the back of my neck and squeezing them as tight as I could, hoping that a finger wouldn't come up and be nipped off. Pain came in, hot and high, but the claws didn't dig as deep as they would have if this had been a malk or a ghoul, and I had to hope the damage wouldn't be too serious, unless the fight went on long enough for blood loss to weaken me. Some analytical part of my head was going over those facts in a detached and rational fashion. The rest of me went freaking berserk with anger. I got one arm beneath me to brace myself and threw the other elbow back in a heavy strike that slammed into something soft and drew a startled yelp out of my attacker. The teeth vanished for a second and the claws slowed. I rolled, shoving with a broad motion of that same arm, and threw a wolf the size of a Great Dane off of my back. It hit one of the computer tables with a tremendous racket, sending bits of equipment tumbling. I got my feet underneath me, seized a computer chair by its back, and lifted it. By the time the wolf with dark red fur was getting back onto its feet, the chair was already halfway through its swing, and I was snarling in incoherent fury. Only at the last second did I recognize my attacker through my rage and divert the arc of the descending chair. It broke into about 50 pieces when it hit the floor just in front of the wolf, plastic and metal tumbling in every direction. The wolf flinched back from the flying bits and lifted its eyes toward mine. It froze in what was an expression of perfect shock, and in a pair of seconds the wolf was gone, its form melting rapidly into the shape of a girl. A redhead with generous curves and not a stitch of clothing. She stared at me, gasping in short breaths, her expression pained before she whispered,
"Harry?"
"Andy," I said, standing straighter and trying to force my body to relax. The word came out in a snarl. Adrenaline still sang along my arms and legs, and more than anything in the whole world at that moment, I wanted to punch someone in the face, anyone, it didn't matter who. And that was not right. "Andy," I said, forcing myself to quiet and gentle my voice, "what the hell are you doing here?" "Me?" she breathed. I'm not the one who's dead." "The night is young," thought the furious part of me, but I fought it down. "Rumors. Death. Exaggerated," I said instead. "And I don't have time to chat about it." I turned toward Bob at his desk and heard Andy open a drawer behind me. The sound an automatic makes when someone racks the slide and pops around into the chamber is specific and memorable, and gets your attention as effectively as if it were also really, really loud. "Get your hands away from the skull," said Andy's shortened, pained voice, "or I put a bullet in you." I paused. My first impulse was to cover the floor of the computer room with frozen chunks of Andy, and what the hell was I thinking? It was the anger that kept on rolling through me in cold waves that was pushing for that, for action, for violence. Don't get me wrong, it's not like I exactly have an allergy to either of those things, but I'd always done a reasonably good job of keeping my temper under control. I hadn't felt like this in years, not since the first days I'd nearly been killed by the White Council. I fell back on what I'd learned then. I closed my eyes and took a few deep breaths, reminding myself that the anger was just anger, that it was a sensation, like feeling hot or cold. It didn't mean anything by itself. It wasn't a reason to act. That's what thinking was for. The old lessons helped, and I separated myself from the fury. I put my hands slowly out to my sides, making sure they were visible. Then I turned to face Andy. She stood with a pistol in a solid weaver stance, like she learned how from someone who knew. I could deflect bullets if I had to do it, but I couldn't stop them. And we were in a building full of innocent bystanders. "You know about the skull?" I asked. "Kind of hard not to," she said, "since I live here." I blinked several times. "You and... damn, way to go, Butters." Andy stared steadily down the sights of her gun. She was holding herself a little hitched, as if her right side pained her. That elbow I'd thrown must have caught her in the ribs. I winced. I don't mind a little of the rough and tumble when necessary, but I don't hit my friends. I don't hit women. And Andy was both. "Sorry about that," I said, nodding toward her. "I didn't know it was you." "And I still don't know if it's you," she replied. "Especially with you dead and all, there are plenty of things that might try to look like Harry." "Bob," I said over my shoulder, "tell her it's me."
"Can't," Bob said in a dreamy tone. "Boobs."
Right. Because Andy was naked, I'd seen her that way before, because that was one of the hazards of being a werewolf. I knew several, and they'd been my friends. When they change form, clothes and things don't go with, so when they change back, they're stark naked. I'll give Bob this much. The little creep had good taste. Changing into a wolf must be a really fantastic exercise regimen, because Andy and naked went really well together. Although, at the moment, I was mostly impressed with her great, big, slightly heaving gun. "Bob," I said more urgently. I put my hand out, trying to get it between the skull and Andy without actually reaching for it.
"Hey," Bob demanded. "Damn it, Harry, it's not like I get much of a chance to see him."
Andy's eyes widened.
"Bob? Is it really him?"
"Yes, but he works for the bad guys now," Bob said. "It's probably safest to shoot him."
"Hey," I said.
"Nothing personal," Bob assured me. "What would you advise a client to do if the Winter Knight broke into her place, fought with her, and cracked two of her ribs?"
Not to shoot, I said. The bullet's going to bounce, and there are way too many people in the apartments around us. At that, Andy took her finger off the trigger, though she left it extended and pressed against the guard. She exhaled slowly.
That's more like what I would expect from you, Harry, she swallowed. Is it really you?
Whatever's left of me, I said.
We heard about your ghost. I could even sort of smell you when you were near. I knew. We thought you were dead.
Wasn't really my ghost, I said. It was me. I just sort of forgot to bring my body along with me. I coughed. Think you could maybe point that somewhere else?
My finger's not on the trigger, she said. Don't be such a baby. I'm thinking.
She watched me for a moment and said,
Okay, let's assume it's really you. What are you doing here?
I came for the skull, I said.
I'm invaluable, Bob piped.
Useful, I scowled at him. Don't get cocky.
I know you came for the skull, Andy said. Why now? In the middle of the night? Why break in? Harry, all you had to do was ask.
I ground my teeth. Andy, I don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to give you the short answer, okay?
Okay.
When I break in here and take something from Butters, he's my victim and of no particular consequence. If I come here and ask him for help, he's my accomplice, and it makes him a target for the people I'm working against. She frowned.
What people?
I sighed. That's the kind of thing I'd tell an accomplice, Andy.
She said, isn't that kind of what we are?
It's what you were, I said with gentle emphasis. Bob's right. I'm not exactly on the side of the angels right now. And I'm not taking you and Butters down the drain with me.
Say, Harry, Bob asked, who are you up against?
Not in front of the eye-stander, Bay, I said.
Just trolling for info like a good lackey, Bob said. You understand.
Sure, I said. Andy frowned.
Bob isn't he supposed to be yours?
I'm not the present owner of the skull, I said. Whoever has the skull has Bob's loyalty.
Services, Bob corrected me. Don't get cocky. And right now I'm working for Butters. And you, of course, Toots.
Toots, Andy said in a flat voice. Did you really just say that? Her gaze shifted to me.
Bystander?
If you don't know anything, I said, there's no reason for anyone to torture you to death to find it. That made her face turn a little pale. These people think the Saw movies were hilarious, I said. They'll hurt you because for them, it feels better than sex. They won't hesitate. And I'm trying to give you all the cover I can, you and Butters both. I shook my head and lowered my hands. I need you to trust me, Andy. I'll have Bob back here before dawn. She frowned.
Why by then?
Because I don't want the people I work for to get hold of him either, I said. He's not the same thing as a human.
Thank you, Bob said. I explain and explain that, but no one listens.
But he's still kind of a friend. Bob made a gagging sound.
Don't get all sappy on me, Dresden.
Andy, I said, ignoring him. I don't have any more time. I'm going to pick up the skull now. You going to shoot me or what? Andy let out a short, frustrated breath and sagged back against the table. She lowered the gun, grimaced, and slipped one hand across her stomach to press against her ribs on the other side. I didn't look at what that motion did to her chest, because that would have been grotesquely inappropriate, regardless of how fascinating the resulting contours may or may not have been. I picked up the skull, an old, familiar shape and weight in my hand. There was a flitter in the flickering eyelights and maybe a subtle change of hue in the flames.
All right, Bob crowed. Back in the saddle.
Pipe down, I said. I've got backup with me. The other team might have surveillance on me that's just as invisible. I'd rather they not listen to every word.
Piping down, O mighty one, Bob replied.
When I turned back to Andy, she looked horrified.
Oh, God, Harry, you're back.
I grunted, twisted a bit, and got a look at myself in the reflection in the window. My jacket was in tatters and stained with blots of blood. It hurt, but not horribly, maybe as much as a bad sunburn.
I'm sorry, Andy said.
I'll live, I said. I walked over to her, leaned down, and kissed the top of her head. I'm sorry about your ribs and the computers. I'll make up the damages to you guys. She shook her head.
Don't worry about it. Whatever, you know. Whatever we can do to help.
I sighed and said, yeah, about that. I'm sorry about this, too. She frowned and looked up at me.
About what?
I was going to deck her, clip her on the chin and put her down for a few moments while I left. That would do two things. First, it would prevent her from getting all heroic and following me. Second, if I was currently being observed, it would sell the notion that I'd stolen Bob from her. It was a logical, if ruthless, move that would give her an extra layer of protection, however thin. But when I told my hand to move, it wouldn't. Winter night, Mab's assassin, whatever, I don't hit girls. I sighed. I'm sorry I can't deck you right now. She lifted both eyebrows.
Oh, you think you'd be protecting me, I take it.
As screwed up as it is to think that, yeah, I would be.
I've been protecting myself just fine for a year, Harry, Andy said, even without you around.
Ouch, I winced. Andy looked down.
I didn't, sorry.
No worries, I said. Better call the police after I'm gone. Report an intruder. It's what you'd do if a burglar had broken in. She nodded.
Is it all right if I talk to Butters about it?
This whole thing would have been a lot simpler if I could have kept anyone from getting involved. That had been the point of the burglary. But now, well, Andy knew, and I owed her more than to ask her to keep secrets from Butters, whom I owed even more. Carefully, I said, behind your threshold, and maybe not anyone else just yet, okay?
Okay, she said quietly.
Thanks. I didn't know what else to say, so I added another, I'm sorry. Then I took the skull and hurried back out into the night. Chapter 11. Once I was in the hearse again, I started driving. I had a silent and nearly invisible squadron of the Tsar Lord's guard flying in a loose formation around the car, except for Toot, who perched on the back of the passenger seat. Bob's skull sat in the seat proper, its glowing eye sockets turned toward me.
So, boss,
Bob said brightly,
where are we headed?
Nowhere yet, I said, but I'm operating on the theory that a moving target is harder to hit.
That's a little more paranoid than usual,
Bob said.
I approve. But why?
I grimaced. Mab wants me to kill Maeve.
What?
Bob squeaked. Toot fell off the back of the passenger seat in a fit of shock. You heard me, I said. You okay, Toot?
Just checking for assassins, my lord,
Toot said gamely.
All clear back here.
That doesn't make any sense, Bob said. Tell me everything.
So I did. And then she told me to kill Maeve, I finished. And I decided to come looking for you.
Wait, Bob said. Let me get this straight. Mab gave you a whole girl all to yourself, and you didn't even get to first base.
I scowled. Bob, can you focus, please? This isn't about the girl. Bob snorted.
Making this the first time it hasn't been about the girl, I guess.
Maeve, Bob, I said. What I need to know is why Mab would want her dead.
Maybe she's trying to flunk you, intentionally, Bob said.
Why do you say that?
Because you can't kill Maeve, Harry.
I don't want to do it, I said. I'm not even sure if I'm going to.
You're too busy wrestling with your stupid conscience to listen to me, boss,
Bob said.
You can't kill her. Not might, not shouldn't. Can't.
I blinked several times. Why not?
Maeve's an immortal, Harry. One of the least of the immortals, maybe, but immortal all the same. Chop her up if you want to. Burn her. Scatter her ashes to the winds. But it won't kill her. She'll be back. Maybe in months, maybe years, but you can't just kill her. She's the Winter Lady.
I frowned.
Huh. I killed the Summer Lady just fine.
Bob made a frustrated sound.
Yeah, but that was because you were in the right place to do it.
How's that?
Mab and Titania created that place specifically to be a killing ground for immortals, a place where balances of power are supposed to change. They've got to have a location like that for the important fights. Otherwise nothing really gets decided. It's a waste of everyone's time and cannon fodder.
I'd seen part of that place being created, with my sight, no less, and it was burned indelibly into my memory. I saw the surging energy the two queens of fairy were pouring out, power on a level that defied description. And, of course, I had, in some sense, been in that place when I murdered Lloyd Slate and took his job as Mab's trigger man. Memory. The ancient stone table stained with blood. Stars wheeling above me, dizzying in their speed and clarity. Writhing, cold mist, reaching up over the edges of the table, clutching at my bare skin, while Mab bestrode me, her naked beauty strangling me, raking my thoughts out through my eyes. Power surging through me, into me, from the blood in the swirling grooves of the table, from Mab's hungry will. I shuddered and forced the memory away. My hands clenched the wheel. So I can't kill her. I said quietly.
No,
Bob said. I glowered out at the road. What is the point of telling me to do something she knows is impossible? I wondered aloud. You're sure about this, Bob? There's no way at all without the stone table?
Not really, Bob said, his eyes flicking around the car. And not in most of the never-never, either.
Hey, I said, what's with the shifty eyes?
What shifty eyes? Bob asked.
When you said not really, your eyes got all shifty.
No, they didn't.
Bob, the skull sighed.
Do I have to tell you?
Dude, I said, since when has it been like that between us?
Since you started working for her,
Bob said, and somehow managed to shudder. I tilted my head, thinking as hard as I could. Wait, this has to do with your feud with Mab?
Not a feud, Bob said. In a feud, both sides fight. This is more like me screaming and running away before she rips me apart.
I shook my head. Man, Bob, I know you can be an annoying git when you want to be one, but what did you do to make Mab mad at you?
It isn't what I do, Harry,
Bob said in a very small voice.
It's what I know.
I lifted an eyebrow. It took a lot to make the skull flinch. And what is that exactly? The lights in the eye sockets dwindled to tiny pinpoints, and his voice came out in a whisper.
I know how to kill an immortal.
Like Maeve? I asked him.
Maeve, Bob said. Mab, Mother Winter, any of them.
Holy crap. Now that was a piece of information worth killing for. If the skull knew how to subtract the M from immortal, then he could be a source of danger to beings of power throughout the universe. Hell, he was lucky that gods and demons and supernatural powers everywhere hadn't formed up in a safari and come gunning for him. And it meant that maybe I wasn't looking at an impossible mission after all. I'd like you to tell me, I said.
No way, Bob said. No way. The only reason I've been around this long is that I've kept my mouth shut. If I start shooting it off now, Mab and every other immortal with an interest in this stupid planet are going to smash my skull to powder and leave me out to fry in the sun.
The eye lights bobbed toward the rear compartment.
And there are too many ears around here.
Toot, I said. Get everybody out of the car. I need privacy. Make sure no one gets close enough to eavesdrop.
Ow,
Toot complained from the rear compartment.
Not even me.
You're the only one I can trust to keep those other mugs from doing it, Major General. No one overhears, got it? I could practically hear the pride bursting out of his voice.
Got it, he piped. Will do, my lord.
He rolled down a window and buzzed out. I rolled it back up and took a look around the hearse, with both normal and supernatural senses, to be sure it was empty. Then I turned back to the skull. Bob, it's just you and me talking here. Think about this. Mab sends me off to kill Maeve, something that would be impossible for me to do on my own. And she knew that you know how to do it. She knew the first thing I would do is come back here, as the first step in the job. I think she meant for me to come to you. I think she meant for you to tell me. The skull considered that for a moment.
It's indirect and manipulative, so you're probably onto something. Let me think.
A long minute went by. Then he spoke very quietly.
If I tell you, he said, you've got to do something for me.
Like what?
A new vessel, he said. You've got to make me a new house, somewhere I can get to it. Then if they come after this one, I've got somewhere else to go.
Tall order for me, I said soberly. You've basically got your own little pocket dimension in there. I've never tried anything that complicated before. Not even Little Chicago.
Promise me, Bob said. Promise me on your power.
Swearing by one's power is how a wizard makes a verbal contract. If you break your word, your ability with magic starts to fray, and if you keep doing it, sooner or later, it'll just wither up and die. A broken promise sworn by my power could set me back years and years in terms of my ability to use magic. I held up my hand. I swear on my power to construct a new vessel for you if you tell me, Bob, assuming I survive the next few days. Just don't expect a deluxe place like you have now. The flickering eye lights flared up to their normal size again.
Don't worry, boss, Bob said with compassion. I won't.
Wise ass.
Right, then, Bob said. The only way to kill an immortal is at certain specific places.
And you know one? Where?
Ha! Already you're making a human assumption. There are more than three dimensions, Harry. Not all places are in space. Some of them are places in time. They're called conjunctions.
I know about conjunctions, Bob, I said, annoyed. When the stars and planets align, you can use them to support heavy-duty magic sometimes.
That's one way to measure a conjunction, said the skull. But stars and planets are ultimately just measuring stakes used to describe a position in time. And that's one way to use a conjunction, but they do other things, too.
I nodded thoughtfully. And there's a conjunction when immortals are vulnerable?
Give the man a cookie. He's got the idea. Every year.
When is it?
On Halloween night, of course.
I slammed on the brakes and pulled the car to the side of the road.
Say that again? Halloween, Bob said, his voice turning sober. It's when the world of the dead is closest to the mortal world. Everyone, everything, standing in this world is mortal on Halloween.
I let out a low, slow whistle.
I doubt there are more than a couple of people alive who know that, Harry, Bob said. And the immortals will keep it that way.
Why are they so worried? I asked. I mean, why not just not show up on Halloween night?
Because it's when they... He made a frustrated noise. It's hard to explain, because you don't have the right conceptual models. You can barely count to four dimensions.
I think the math guys can go into the teens, skip the insults, and try.
Halloween is when they feed, Bob said. Or refuel, or run free. It's all sort of the same thing. And I'm only conveying a small part of it. Halloween night is when the locked stasis of immortality becomes malleable. They take in energy, and it's when they can add new power to their mantle. Mostly they steal tiny bits of it from other immortals.
Those Kemlerite freaks and their dark hallow, I breathed. That was Halloween night.
Exactly, Bob said. That ritual was supposed to turn one of them into an immortal, and the same rule applies. That's the only night of the year it actually can happen. I doubt all of them knew that it had to be that night. But I bet you Cal did. Guy is seriously scary.
Seriously in need of a body cast and a therapist, more like. I raked at my too long, too messy hair with my fingers, thinking. So, on Halloween, they're here. All of them?
Any who are... The only word I can come close with is awake. Immortals aren't always moving through the time stream at the same rate as the universe. From where you stand, it looks like they're dormant. They aren't. You just can't perceive the true state of their existence properly.
They're here, I said slowly, feeding and swindling one another for little bits of power.
Right.
They're trick-or-treating?
Duh,
Bob said.
Where do you think that comes from?
Ah, this whole time? That is creepy beyond belief.
I think it was the second or third Merlin of the White Council who engineered the whole Halloween custom. That's the real reason people started wearing masks on that night back in the day. It was so that any hungry immortal who came by might think twice before gobbling someone up. After all, they could never be sure the person behind the mask wasn't another immortal setting them up.
Halloween is tomorrow night, I said. A bank sign I was passing told me it was a bit after 2 a.m. Or tonight, I guess, technically.
What a coincidence,
Bob said.
Happy birthday, by the way. I didn't get you anything.
Except maybe my life. It's okay. I'm kind of birthdayed out already. I rubbed at my jaw. So, if I can get to Maeve on Halloween night, I can kill her.
Well, Bob hedged, you can try, anyway. It's technically possible. It doesn't mean you're strong enough to do it.
How big of a window do I have? When does Halloween night end? I asked.
At the first natural morning bird song, Bob replied promptly. Songbirds, rooster, whatever. They start to sing, the night ends.
Oh, good. A deadline. I narrowed my eyes, thinking. Gives me a bit more than 24 hours, then, I muttered. And all I have to do is find her, when she can be anywhere in the world, or the Never-Never, then get her here, then beat her down, all without her escaping or killing me first. Simple.
Yep, almost impossible, but simple. And at least you know the when and the how, Bob said.
But I'm no closer to why.
Can't help you there, boss, the skull said. I'm a spirit of intellect, and the premise we're dealing with makes no sense.
Why not?
Because there's no reason for it, Bob said, his tone unhappy. I mean, when Maeve dies, there will just be another Maeve.
I frowned. What do you mean? Bob sighed.
You keep thinking of the fairy queens as specific individuals, Harry, Bob said. But they aren't individuals. They're mantles of power. Roles, positions. The person in them is basically an interchangeable part.
I frowned. What, like being the Winter Knight is?
Exactly like that, Bob said. When you killed Slate, the power, the mantle, just transferred over to you. It's the same for the Queens of Faerie. Maeve wears the mantle of the Winter Lady. Kill her, and you'll just get a new Winter Lady.
Maybe that's what Mab wants, I said.
Doesn't track, Bob said.
Why not? I asked.
Because the mantle changes whoever wears it.
My guts felt suddenly cold. I'm not Lloyd Slate. Neither was he. Not at first.
Doesn't matter who it is, Bob prattled on. Over time it changes them. Somewhere down the line you wouldn't be able to find much difference between Maeve and her successor. Meet the new Maeve, same as the old Maeve.
I swallowed. So Lily, who took the summer lady's mantle after I killed Aurora...
It's been, what, 10 years or so? She's gone by now, or getting there, Bob said. Give it another decade or two, tops, and she might as well be Aurora.
I was quiet for a moment. Then I asked, is that going to happen to me, too? Bob hedged.
You've probably felt it starting. Strong impulses. intense emotions, that kind of thing. It builds, and it doesn't stop.
He managed to give the impression of a wince.
Sorry, boss.
I stared at my knuckles for a moment. So, I said, even if I frag this Maeve, another one steps up. Maybe not for decades, but she does.
Immortals don't really care about decades, boss, Bob said. To them, it's like a few weeks are to you.
I nodded thoughtfully. Then maybe it's about the timing.
How so?
I shrugged. Hell if I know, but it's the only thing I can think of. Maybe Mab wants a less Maeve-ish Maeve for the next few years.
Why?
Bob asked. I growled.
I already have one. Why? I don't need you adding more.
I drummed my fingers on the steering wheel.
Why doesn't Mab do it herself?
Oh, I see. It's okay if you add more whys. You have complicated rules, Harry.
I ignored that with the disdain it deserved. I'm serious. Mab has the power. What's stopping her from tearing Maeve to shreds?
Something,
Bob suggested.
I can't believe I got my tux shredded for brilliant analysis like that, I said.
Hey, Bob said. I just told you something so valuable that it could save your life. Or get you killed.
Yeah, I sighed. You did, but it isn't enough. I need more information.
You do know a few people around here, Bob said.
I growled.
My physical therapist, who I've known for 3 whole months, nearly died tonight because she showed up at a party with me. And that was with Mab looking over my shoulder as a referee.
How is that any different from the last time you played with fairies?
Because now I know them, I said. It was actually sort of scary looking back at the me from a decade ago. That guy was terrifying in his ignorance. Aurora and her crew were basically a decent crowd. Misguided, yeah. But to them, we were the bad guys. They were tough, but they weren't killers. Maeve's different.
How?
Bob asked. She doesn't have limits, I said.
And you figure you're up against her.
I know I am, I said. And she's grown powerful enough to challenge Mab in her own court. I also know more about Mab now, and all of it scares the crap out of me. I snorted and felt a tremble of winged insects in my midsection. And apparently Maeve is a threat to her, and I'm supposed to deal with it. Bob whistled.
Well, maybe that explains it.
Explains what?
Why Mab was so hell-bent on getting you to be the new knight, Bob said. I mean, you're kind of an avatar of the phrase, things fall apart. Mab has a target she wants to be absolutely sure of. You're like her guided missile. She can't know exactly what's going to happen, but she knows there's going to be a great big boom.
I'm a missile, huh?
Her big dumb bunker buster, he said cheerily. Of course, you know the thing about missiles, Harry.
Yeah, I said as I put the caddy back in gear again. They're expendable.
Buck up, little camper. At least you had a hot redhead jump your bones tonight. Not the right bone, but you can't have everything.
I snorted. Thanks, Bob.
Andy totally got the drop on you. Where was your tiny Secret Service team?
I forgot to invite them past the threshold, I said. Besides, I think she'd hit me before anyone could have shouted a lookout anyway.
You ever think about replacing them with some real bodyguard goons, Harry? I know a thing that knows a thing.
Screw that. Toot and his gang aren't exactly gangsters, but I trust them. That means more.
That means you're a sucker, Bob said. Did the X-Files teach you nothing? Trust no one.
I grunted. Cat Sith gave me almost the same advice.
Ugh, Bob said. That guy. He's still got the attitude.
I feel safe in assuming that he does.
I don't like him, but he's no dummy, Bob said. At least he gives good advice.
Mathematically, maybe, I said. But trust isn't one of those things that lends itself well to math.
Sure it does, Bob said. You trust somebody, they betray you. You get a negative value. You never trust, they can never disappoint you. You break even.
I laughed. God. Or you trust, it's vindicated, and you're better off.
Shah, Bob said. Like that happens.
Life's about more than breaking even, I said. Bob snorted.
Which is why the first thing you did when you got back to town was call all your friends and immediately tell them you needed their help and trust them to help you.
I scowled out at the road.
It wasn't like the first thing you did was abuse one of your friends and inflict property damage on his house and steal a powerful magical counselor whose loyalties are transferable to whoever happens to be holding an old skull, presumably so that you'd have a lackey who would agree with whatever you said instead of give you a hard time about it. And the only beings you're allowing to help you are a bunch of tiny fairies who worship the ground you walk on because you buy them pizza.
Bob snorted.
I can see how important trust is to you, boss.
That's why I got you, clearly, I said, because I wanted a yes man, and you're so good for that.
Hey, I'm just a mirror, boss. Not my fault you're ambivalent.
I'm not ambivalent.
You know better, but you're being a moron about it anyway, Bob said. If that ain't ambivalence, maybe Mab's getting to you, because it's a little crazy, he sniffed. Besides, if you weren't of two minds about it, I wouldn't be giving you this kind of crap now, would I?
I was going to say something sarcastic, but the red glare of a stoplight suddenly appeared about 10 feet in front of the old caddy's nose. I stared at the light for a fraction of a second, and then mashed the brakes down. I had an instant to see that it wasn't a traffic signal, but Toot Toot, his aura glaring brilliant scarlet, frantically waving his arms at me. As the caddy lumbered forward, I saw him take a couple of steps forward, running up the windshield and up out of sight above me. As the heavy old piece of Detroit iron began to slide on the asphalt, I saw an object tumble out of the air in front of me and hit the street, turning over and over. I had another instant to recognize a plain black nylon duffel bag. And then the world went white. And a hammer the size of the Chrysler Building slammed me back against the old caddy's seat. Chapter 12. The bomb might have been 50 feet away when it exploded. Mab's therapy had paid off. On raw instinct, I'd already begun to form a defensive shield in front of me when everything went boom. I hadn't had time to build much of a shield, but what little I could do probably kept me conscious. Explosions are unbelievably loud. If you haven't been near one, there's no way to convey the sheer violence of it. It doesn't really register as a sound the way a gunshot will. There's just this single, terrible power in the air, a sudden hammer blow of disorienting pressure, as if you've been hit by a truck made of pillow-top mattresses. Your hearing goes. There's a familiar high-pitched tone, only no one is telling you that this is a test of the emergency broadcast system. There's dust and smoke everywhere, and you can't see. Your muscles don't all work right. You tell them to move, and it's iffy. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. It's hard to tell which way is down. Not that you don't know it rationally somewhere in your head, but your body just seems to forget its natural awareness of gravity. Even if something sharp and fast doesn't go flying through some of your favorite organs, a nearby explosion leaves you half-blind, deaf, and drunkenly impaired. Vulnerable. One moment the caddy was screeching and sliding toward that black duffel bag. The next I was staring at a cloud of dust and the dim image of a brick wall at the end of the caddy's nose. The windshield had been splintered into a webwork of cracks that made it hard to see. My chest hurt like hell. I picked fitfully at it, my fingers clumsy, and thought to myself that the car Sith had provided must have had armored glass, or there would be windshield mixed in with my intestines. Lights danced and darted in my vision. My eyes wouldn't focus enough to track them. Smells were incredibly sharp. The air was acrid, thick with smoke, laced with the scents of things it is unhealthy to burn. I smelled gasoline nearby. There were wires hanging down from something in the corner of my vision, outside the car, spitting white sparks. None of it seemed normal, but I couldn't quite remember the right word to describe it. Danger. Right, that was it. Danger. I was in danger. A moving target is harder to hit. I pushed open the passenger door and stumbled out of the car, choking on dust. Another car wreck?
Man, Mike was going to charge me a small fortune to fix the Blue Beetle this time. Did I have the money in the bank? I couldn't remember whether I had deposited my last stipend check from the wardens. No, wait. The car I'd just gotten out of wasn't the Blue Beetle, my trusty old Volkswagen bug that had died in the line of duty. It was the creepy Herman Munster hot rod my boss had gotten me. My brain finished rebooting and things snapped back into focus. Someone had just tried to bomb me back into the Stone Age. I shook my head, gagging on dust, then dragged the Red Cap's hat down off my head and over my mouth as a dust mask. The caddy was up on the curb and had hit a building. The building had gotten the worst of it. One of the caddy's headlights was out, its front fender crumpled a bit, and the passenger door had been thrown open, but otherwise the car was fine. Maybe 10 or 12 square feet of brick wall had fallen out, some of it onto the hood, some of it onto the sidewalk. I looked around. It was hard to see through the dust. There were a lot of busted-up walls, several small fires. A street light had come swinging down from the line that supported it. That was where the sparking cables came from. Lights still darted and flickered randomly, and I blinked, trying to clear the stars away. But stars in the vision were usually white and silver. These were orange and red, like the embers of a fire. Then one of those lights pivoted in midair and flashed toward my eyes. I jerked away from it, still clumsy, and a sudden spike of agony burned through my face. I screamed and staggered to one knee. Something had gone through my cheek and was still there, tacking the damn Cincinnati cap to my face. I reached for it on instinct, but before I could get to it, pain exploded from my back, from the fresh wounds there, from my bruised hands, from my throat where the Red Cap had nearly crushed it. That did put me on the ground. It was too much to process, much less ignore. I reacted on blind animal instinct, swiping at the most intense source of pain with my paw. There was another flash of agony, and suddenly the hat came away from my face. A bloodied nail, a good 4 inches long, fell away with the hat, its last 2 inches bloodied, its other end swathed in duct tape. The instant it came free, I felt my pain recede again, back to the dull background annoyance it had been a few moments before. My thoughts cleared as the agony retreated. Someone had shot me? With a freaking nail gun? What the hell was going on here? No sooner had I thought that than another light flashed toward me, and before I could react, a second round of utterly ridiculous levels of pain slammed through me, starting at my leg. The other pains resurfaced with the fresh addition of my throbbing face. I screamed and squatted and tore a second nail, much like the first, from the flesh of my right quadriceps. Again that cold power flooded into me, making pain distant, making thoughts more clear. The ember-colored lights were coming at me too fast. There was no time to get a defensive spell up, not in my condition, and my body, winter night or not, wasn't fast enough to dodge or swat them out of the way. Even as I processed those thoughts, a third nail hit me in the left arm, and I had to scream and thrash my way out of another spike of pure agony. I felt utterly helpless and stunned at my inability to overcome so tiny a foe. And I suddenly knew how the late summer lady Aurora had felt at the end. "Get up, Harry. Get up, Harry," I panted, fighting through the disorientation, the polar shifts in pain. "Get up before they nail you." Nail you, get it? But I always joke when I'm afraid, and I was terrified. Whatever these things were, if they got more than one of those nails into me, I doubted I would be able to hold my thoughts together long enough to get them out again. I had a gruesome vision of myself stretched in lifeless, agonized rigor on the sidewalk, nails sticking out of every square inch of my skin. I tried to scramble, to evade, but compared to the darting motes of light, I was moving in slow-motion replay. Half a dozen more of the glimmering things came arrowing toward me out of the night, zooming at me in a flying V formation, and I knew things were about to get really bad. Then someone blew on a coach's whistle, a sound I heard even through my stunned ears, and a tiny, distant voice piped, "To the Tsar, Lord!" Half a dozen tiny, cool blue spheres of light flashed toward my attackers, intercepting them only a couple of feet from my body. 6 explosions of sparks and glowing motes lit the night, various colors swirling and spinning as the tiny soldiers of the Tsar Lord's guard